Rob Wolf, Andy Dees. What's up, dude?
Dude, vasectomy reversal 2 days ago. So I'm gort on meds, and I have a ice pack on my crotch.
Wow, you really had to bring that up, didn't you? I thought we were going to be able to scoot right past
Nope,
that.
nope. Too much. The TMI is kind of my trademark. So,
Yeah, Rob Wolf is always Rob Wolf. For
unless
better or worse.
the drugs have really set in which case I'm Roberto Lobo. So.
So, episode 15, Rob, I was thinking today, I feel really vindicated on this Prayer of the Roller Boys thing because I feel like half the people that responded on the blog were familiar with what I was talking about. So I'm not the only moron that spent their youth watching bad movies.
Hey man, there are a ton of people who piss their lives away on the internet. So you found good company, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and I was reminded of it this morning because we were working on the goals board at the gym for 6 month goals. And, and there's some good ribbing between people about whether or not their goals are realistic and stuff. And someone was kind of giving me grief about my goals. And I'm like, dude, this is my vision quest. And all these girls like look at me with this blank stare. But you see all these men that are between like 26 and 40, they get this little smile on their face. They're like, oh, yeah, I remember that movie. I'm like, ah, oh, that's a great.
If you can't tie it into a movie reference, then it really has no basis in reality. So,
That's unfortunately, I think, how my world operates some days.
yeah. You just need to spend some time with Greg Everett to really have that come to life.
Oh,
So,
all right. That would be good. I think I need he might make it worse, or he might be too far over the edge, and I'll need to step back and look at it in all alternate terms.
yeah, he can pull anything from news radio, Family Guy, in literally any movie he's ever seen. He only needs like one pass through it. And he pretty much has like full memory retrieval. He and Kelly Starrett are the closest like photographic memory folks that I've ever met.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, before we get started, anything else? Anyone's trying to kill you this week? You survived surgery, which I guess is positive and saved your
Survived
life.
surgery, just spent about 2 hours on the phone with Professor Cordain and talking about a kind of advanced topics, Paleolithic nutrition seminar that we're going to wheel out. Hopefully, get like some Matt Lalonde action on that, but not too many details yet. Other than this is going to be like a fully accredited gig, potential for some university credits on it, and some stuff like that. So it's going to be fully legit and several stratifications to it. So like you could roll into this thing with no basic science background and get some goods, which would be real similar to what I'm doing with the Paleolithic Solution seminar, and then you can chase that all the way up to like a MD PhD type level. So it's going to cover everything from the very very fundamentals of Paleolithic nutrition all the way up to like protocols for getting people off of statins, off of blood thinners, and using non-conventional means, but basically Paleolithic nutrition.
Nice. All
Yeah,
right.
so that's very, very exciting.
I also wanted to thank the reader for sharing the video of Laura DeMarco deadlifting 370 pounds.
Yes, made me feel like a complete putz.
Not only that, but I was talking to someone. I said, my favorite part of that video is when she picked it up, and there was just like sheer joy on her face. Like she was like so in the moment, and I was like, wow, dude, that is awesome.
Yeah, Laura's awesome. She's very, very cool chick. Awesome athlete, super cool person.
And not a vegan anymore.
And not a vegan anymore. Yeah.
Right, so enough goofing off to the questions.
Yes.
Okay, question one from Raquel. She says, Rob, I'm frustrated. I live in Ithaca, New York, which is home to Cornell and a man named T. Colin Campbell. One of the lead researchers of the famous China study, she admits that she hasn't read the book, but read enough books through my studies as a nutrition educator and have enough discussions with my own nutritionist about protein versus carbs. So at this party, it's never good when you're talking about this at a party. So at this party were two of T. Collins' minions talking about how we should eat only 6 to 10% protein, 10 to 15% fat, and the rest in carbs because people who ate the most animal-based foods got the most chronic disease. People who ate the most plant-based foods were the healthiest and tended to avoid chronic disease. One study they cited was where Campbell fed rats different amounts of casein, soy, and wheat protein. Apparently, the rats who ate the casein were the sickest. Could you talk about some of the main proteins, their sources, and what biochemical importance or not they have in the human body? I know rats are quite the scavengers, but don't think their bodies were meant to digest cheese and milk all day long. Neither are ours. So it seems to me that the study is flawed from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. You could maybe say that. You know, one thing here intellectual balance, you know, like she admits that she hasn't read the book. You should read the book. The China Study is a well-written book. Campbell, the dude's older than Moses. Like he's almost 80 years old and has been researching his whole life. And like, I have a lot of respect for the dude. He's a professor at Cornell University. He's got a distinguished, research background and all that stuff. I think he's like 90% wrong. But, you know, that stuff aside, like, I think there's a lot of respect that needs to be given to the dude for what he's accomplished and whatnot. And if you're really going to get in and critically assess something, say, like, the China study, you should read the whole damn book just to be able to say, okay, yeah, I read the whole thing. So then we can shift forward to, being like the performance menu, when I was more heavily involved with that, we would receive this question and I would receive this question almost daily. You know, what about the China study? I just read this book, The China Study. My next door neighbor told me about the China study. So in an effort to kind of put this whole thing to rest, I asked Professor Cordain to do a review of the China study. And he had an even better idea. There had been a point where, I forget what it is, it's the thing that goes on in Colorado, Boulder Fest. Is that right?
No, I think we talked about this last time.
Yeah.
The Berardi people are always at. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was some sort of a wing ding where these folks were supposed to get together, and there was supposed to be some funding for Cordain and Campbell to debate the role of protein in degenerative diseases. And so that's what Cordain suggested. And yeah, we did talk about this one before. So I'm medicated right now, so I can't really remember that. But basically, like, this is the whole protein debate where Cordain just takes point by point and dismantles Campbell. I mean, just absolutely takes him apart on every point about, like, is protein damaging or deleterious to the kidneys? No. Does it cause bone demineralization? No. Does it increase your likelihood of cancer? No. And he just goes through and cites all the studies. Campbell did a completely slappy job on this. He basically approached it as a payday instead of an opportunity to really argue his point. And so that on the epidemiological studies and whatnot, Cordain really took Campbell to task. This final piece here that was mentioned, about the rats being fed casein, soy, and wheat protein. When in any organism's life does it eat casein, does it eat dairy throughout its whole life cycle? Never. And this is one of these fundamental kind of tenets of the paleo diet. Now, we do have points in which we would say, okay, some, paleo plus dairy would be beneficial, like a CrossFit football kind of scenario. You want to get someone big and strong. Dairy is a very potent growth promoter. So we understand all that stuff. But then that said, the fact that dairy is a really potent growth promoter, if that is the primary protein source that you're getting, then there's going to be problems associated with that, primarily uncontrolled cellular growth, aka cancer. And so this is not surprising in the least that you would see this with a 100% of the protein source for an organism being dairy, seeing increased rates of degenerative disease and cancer. You wouldn't expect anything else. And then this also shines a really clear light on how completely clueless the vegetarians are on all this stuff, because they lump casein in with meat and chicken and fish and all the rest of that stuff. Cordain had a paper, and Andy, if you remind me, I will forward it to you, where they did a pretty good study putting young boys on either a meat-based diet, sans dairy, or a mixed diet, but heavily, heavily focused on dairy. And the boys that were heavily focused on dairy, all of them developed what was essentially like a type 2 diabetes-style metabolic derangement, where we saw none of this metabolic impairment with just a meat-only diet. And So there's some very compelling stuff that kind of explains all of this.
Duly noted.
Yeah. So we can definitely add that to a revisiting of the protein debate.
I'm just laughing at the question of, so at this party.
So there it was at this party. Colin Campbell's minions came out of nowhere. They were all skinny, pale, not very happy.
If anyone has learned not to talk about these things at parties, Rob, it's you and I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when people ask me what I do now, I tell them I'm a mechanic. So, yeah.
More tequila, please.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. We got a question from Paul. A pretty long background. We're going to skip most of it other than to say he's pretty sure he's your only fan from Moose Jaw, Canada.
Could be. Although, you know, that is the area, this dude, Preston, who I met when I was at a CrossFit Calgary level one CrossFit cert when I was on the cert team. This dude, Preston, was a 100-meter sprinter, like national caliber 100-meter sprinter. I think I mentioned this guy in a previous podcast too. But he, you know, like you always go through Fran on your, you know, your in-doc deal. And so I told him, I'm like, dude, I just want you to go slow. Just take your time. Don't push at all. And so like the 95-pound thruster just looked like he had a twig in his hands. The guy could do legitimate like one-arm non-kipped pull-ups, so like dead hang one-arm pull-ups. So he basically did, you know, the 21-15-9, real easy on the thruster, barely any type of kip on the pull-up, and he turned a 315, a 335, something like that, his first effort ever. And then we went back into the lecture portion, and we all sat down, and I asked, you know, who got the fastest time, and it was this dude, Preston, who'd smoked everybody in there. This was, by the way, his first CrossFit workout. He had never done anything like this before. And then I asked, Preston, what's your back squat? And he was like, I put four of the big plates on. And we're like, okay. And then he was like, I do that for sets of 10. And we're, So the dude's doing 405-pound back squats for sets of 5, sets of 10. And didn't even really know what the weight was. He just, like, added weight. And he's probably, like, 5'8", buck 85, buck 95, and just built, like, a brick shit house. But it's that thing again, you know, that strength base is obviously really, really valuable. But sorry, that was my digression onto the Saskatchewan deal.
I was going to say that clearly highlights the fact that strength is not important.
No. Strength has no bearing in overall metabolic output at all. Did you know what? Just to keep digressing even a little bit more, Pierre Auger of formerly I can't even remember what his gym is now, but he has a dude who is a nationally ranked power lifter, who he's 180 pounds, and he did a workout that was a CrossFit total that was 1,008 pounds. So it was like a back squat, a press, and a deadlift that totaled 1,008 pounds. He did 10 rounds of that in 4 minutes and some change.
Yeah, I'll post the link. I saw that on OPT's site. It really ticked me off for two reasons. One, those weights are so light in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And two, you see all the form flaws, and it doesn't impact him at all because he's so freaking strong.
Well, honestly, I didn't see much. I thought his form wasn't bad. I thought it was pretty solid.
Not bad, yeah. But considering, let me just say, if I ever completed that workout, I would need perfect form on every one of those lifts to survive.
Well, I would need a forklift. Yeah. So that's the whole other thing. But yeah, that's another one where it's like, you know, Filthy 50 and stuff like that is legit. It's hard. It's mentally challenging. But there's other workouts where, like, do you even have the buy-in? Like, yep. You know, can you even get it done? It's like a Ido Portal's, one of his favorite workouts is 120 standing backflips for time.
Yep.
You know, it's like, okay, cool. You've got big lungs. Do you have a skill set? Do you have all this other stuff? But anyway, that's a whole other digression. So,
can you even get a seat at the table? No.
No.
Anyway.
This dude from Moose Jaw. Sorry.
Our second fan in Moose Jaw. So basically, background. This dude loves caffeine. That's just the bottom line, and I love caffeine, and Rob loves caffeine. So we're going to talk about his questions. Question one, what are your thoughts on caffeine on a paleo diet? Love to hear your thoughts on how it affects metabolism, performance, weight loss, sleep, etc. based on my goals, which basically, lean out, get better, et cetera, all the goals that we all have, is it enough of a factor that I should consider breaking up with Starbucks altogether? Please say no, dot, dot, dot.
So, it's this thing again where I think that there's a therapeutic dose. Unfortunately, I think that therapeutic dose is lower than what most of us end up tackling. It's probably more along the line of like a couple of shots of espresso, maybe about four of them a day instead of like 8 or 12 or 16 like I usually end up subjecting myself to. When I did the update for the Paleolithic Solution seminar, I included in that a fuller accounting of cortisol. I've never really covered cortisol as a standalone topic. We would touch it peripherally in previous talks. Now it's a full-on, a topic. And it's just so damn important, that cortisol, the stress management, it's so important, but it's also so incredibly subjective. What is your individual wiring? Are you wound real tight? Are you real mellow? Do you have like a real mellow work environment? Do you just, are you the type of person that just loves life and like wherever you walk, like daisies pop up after your feet have trod on there? Or are you just like mean and scowling like my wife and everything pisses you off? And so it's so subjective. It's really hard to give a yes or no answer to this, which is what folks are looking for. But I think that there's generally a therapeutic dose. He's living very far north, which I think you're really looking at some of this like light deprivation stuff. I've really been dealing with some seasonal affective disorder type stuff because we've had a super rainy winter thus far in Northern California, like far, far worse than what we've had in like 10 years. And it's really kicked my ass, and the desire for more coffee has been really potent. But then in talking to James Fitzgerald, it's really, really important to tackle seasonal affective stuff from a perspective of cortisol management, because you start getting some cortisol dysregulation going on. And so it's an important thing to keep an eye on. So do you need to break up with Starbucks? Probably not, but you need to keep the therapeutic dose in mind for sure.
Yeah, actually, I used to work with a guy that to moderate his caffeine intake, he would go to Starbucks because he could set an upper limit easier on how much he would spend a day. When he used his home espresso machine, he was up like 16, 20 shots a day, and it would just spin him out.
Yeah, I mean, we do that all the time where we have this really good Cuban-style espresso, Cafe La Llave, and then we have a 10-shot espresso maker, and so it's literally like 4 minutes away from me having like a cup of espresso, which espresso is a little lighter in caffeine theoretically than say like drip coffee is, but it when you're taking it by the tankard, then you can still do some pretty good damage with that.
It's the only way to go, Rob.
Seriously.
All right, second question. What are your thoughts on green tea? I've read several websites that tout it as a miracle drink that, amongst other things, boosts your metabolism and helps you lose weight. What does green tea contain that is so beneficial, or is this not true?
I forget the pronunciation on this stuff, epigallagastin gallate stuff. Like, there are some other when you start off with tea, basically it's what they would consider white tea, and then it gets steamed, which prevents any of the enzymatic conversion of constituents in the tea that would then turn it into like the orange pekoe or basically what we would call black tea, the Lipton tea or like the Earl Grey tea. I'm totally blanking on what that is. But that's all an oxidation process. And interestingly, each one of those steps creates and destroys things that are of remarkable benefit. I don't know how it didn't hit my radar, but black tea actually has some very potent anti-cortisol effects. Like a cup of black tea reduces acute cortisol response, so like from exercise or other types of stress. And green tea doesn't do that. Orange pekoe doesn't do that. Coffee doesn't do that. But then there are some things in green tea that black tea does not do. So I think green tea has some really cool stuff. Interestingly, some of the other constituents in green tea, which are stimulants like these epigallagastin Gallates, I'm mispronouncing that, but that's approximately what it is. These things are also stimulating, but for me, they have kind of a neurological stimulation that really kind of blows me out. Like it's overstimulating. It's like one cup of green tea is like doing a whole bunch of espresso for me. So for some people, green tea is less stimulating. For me, it's more stimulating, and I can't really tolerate it. Whereas black tea, seem to tolerate just fine. So it's again, kind of a subjective deal, and there's all kinds of different beneficial constituents and all this stuff. Probably a good argument to rotate through on these things. Do some green tea one day, do some black tea another day, rotate through on some coffee, have a little espresso in the background all the time, because obviously that's the best stuff on earth, so.
Yeah, and this is the one too where you can mess with. I like to. I have a coffee brewer that we use to brew tea, and I will mix and match based on what's going on. So I might have a green tea in there, some chamomile, some black tea. Just, do new flavors every time. It's like a surprise every time, Rob.
Yeah, and Matt LaLonde makes a really good point of diversifying your toxin load. And you could view that from the type of teas that you're drinking, the type of vegetables that you're eating, or whatever. Like we have several different detoxification pathways in the liver, and our whole body has various kind of detox pathways, but the bulk of the process happens in the liver. And if you could think about this being a kind of a, what are those things that they're almost kind of like gambling related, where you throw like the tennis ball up and then it bounces down and it can go through different slots, and then if it drops in the right slot, then you win a prize. And our metabolic pathways are a little bit like that, where different things will cascade through these different pathways. And if you hammer one metabolic pathway with a ton of stuff, say like cruciferous vegetables, and then you know the cruciferous vegetables have some good things like diindole methane, which we talked about a podcast or two previously as an anti-estrogen thing, that's good. But then the cruciferous vegetables also have some thyroid antagonistic compounds, so that can be bad. And so that's where you want some diversity and some balance and all this stuff. And so it's another good argument for breaking this stuff up a little bit. And completely random, Andy's like, maybe we should cut this
No,
podcast
it's good. I could just see someone creating a spreadsheet to randomize their food intake, and I'm
off. Oh
fearful.
my God. Paleolithic Solution Podcast, making people neurotic one episode at a time.
But point well taken, Rob. Similar to
Cool.
how we should work, attack our training.
That punctuated. What is it? The punctuated equilibrium? Not that's not the term, but it essentially that. You're diversifying everything. Your training, the food intake. I think the one consistency that you really want to try to have is your sleep and low stress. Like to however you can control that.
All right, last question. Even though it appears he knows the answer to this, he wants your take on it. So I've been reading enough and listening to your podcast enough to know the answer to my next question, but I'll ask anyway, just in case you have a different spin when it comes to tea and coffee. What are your thoughts on sweeteners? That is, what would be preferable, sugar, artificial sweetener, or honey?
I would go with the whole whipping cream first. Like I would just sidestep all that stuff entirely. Go with like a whole organic whipping cream with a little bit of cinnamon, which actually tastes pretty darn sweet, and that will work with coffee or tea or whatever you're drinking. And then from there, like if you really want to have some sort of a sweetener, I would really go with like a honey or like a just standard like brown sugar or something over artificial sweeteners. If you're generally eating pretty clean, like you're really not going to desire all that much of that stuff. And usually with phasing it out or going with some of these other alternatives like the whole whipping cream with a little bit of cinnamon, you really end up not desiring all that much sweet.
This reminds me of that point in your Paleolithic Solution talk where you're talking about adding a little whole whipping cream to coffee. And you're like, just add a tablespoon or two. And I just always think, who in their right mind only adds a tablespoon of that to
Usually it's about a 50-50 mix, but we'll just overlook that for right now.
It's worth a shot.
It's worth a shot.
Yeah, and then if you're not meeting your goals, for some reason not leaning out as much as you can try it for a little bit without and see how you roll.
Yeah, and usually one of the scary things about the adding the whole whipping cream is that caffeine is actually a little more fat soluble than it is water soluble, and so that lyophilized, basically the homogenized fat, they do some funky stuff. They put some temperature and pressure on normal cream to make the fat droplets smaller so that they will actually dissolve in water, kind of get emulsified in water. But that makes a really nice carrier for pulling the caffeine out of the aqueous portion of the coffee, and it gets extracted into the lipid portion of the cream. And then that lipid actually, when it gets absorbed into the system, it goes from the intestines into the hepatic portal vein, like via the lymph, and it drops straight off at the liver, and so it gets dropped off into the body very, very quickly and very potently. So that's actually another way that you can get yourself in over your head with regards to the caffeine. Like adding that whole whipping cream kind of increases the caffeine dose you get. You extract more of it.
Yeah, I notice for myself, like every time I go to a seminar or one of yours, and we don't use whole whipping cream at home, and I will, spend a few hours drinking that with coffee, and I notice a significant increase in how that caffeine affects me.
Oh, yeah.
Like flying around the room.
Yeah. It's kind of like when you go out and start drinking NorCal margaritas on an empty stomach, and then you get four or five of them in, and you're like, oh, I definitely will not be driving home tonight. So, and I may be changing the texture of the cab back seat as I drive home. So, yeah, it's funny the stuff that you mix in there, some of the carbonated beverage with booze. Enhances the absorption, and then the really stout fat source in the coffee or tea enhances the absorption too.
All good stuff.
Truly.
All right. Moving on. Question from, how do you think I should say that?
Clee?
Clee.
Clay?
Okay.
Clay?
Clee, maybe.
Yeah, Clea.
All right. That was my best guess. Hey Rob, thank you for such a fountain of information. I'm wondering what you recommend eating when following the Catalyst Athletics WOD. In the performance menu, Greg Evert prescribes 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight for weightlifters. Do you think this goes for the CA WOD 2 or 1 gram per pound of lean weight less? So let's just start there.
I think this stuff does boil down ultimately to how good your digestion is. Like talking to James Fitzgerald, people who are very, very solid in their digestion, good hydrochloric acid production and all that, they may be able to get by with a little bit less protein. But I find most people tend to do better on about that gram of protein per pound of body weight, not even the lean body weight, but the pound of body weight for a variety of reasons. And then even then, I like to see for most people some digestive support to help them process that protein even better.
Background, a little max set for black box, Wendler's 531, switching to the Catalyst WOD, eating paleo for more than a year, super strict since I went to your nutrition seminar in Jacksonville this spring, 100% strict on grains, legumes, and sugar, 95% strict on dairy. In zone measurements, I'm eating roughly 14 to 16 blocks of protein, 4 to 8 blocks of carbs, and a huge amount of fat. Weigh 140 pounds, 14 to 16 hour IF fast, 2 to 3 days a week, 6 grams of omega-3 a day. Is thinking that the CA conditioning workouts are short enough to get by on few carbs. Right now, I kind of crash after longer conditioning workouts unless I eat more carbs. But day to day, the less carbs I eat, the more it feels like I must be smoking crack. Your glycogen replacement article in the Performance Menu, issue 27, suggests that I could eat pretty much all of my carbs for the day after the workout. How important do you think post-workout nutrition is for the CA WOD?
Man, again, this is just real subjective. You have to play with this stuff. I forget what the blog post was, but somebody had posted on there. Oh, I think it was the guy that's the is the Navy SEAL, and he ended up going like a zone, and then paleo zone, and then half carb zone, and each one of those steps, the guy saw a significant uptick in his performance. And I made the comment, that more or less like this is the end all be all kind of holy grail sort of thing. And Russ Green kind of took me to task on that. He was saying, well, you know, there are people that respond much better with higher carb intake and all that. And I was like, oh, yeah, totally. Like, you know, there's some selection bias going on with my site because obviously I kind of function better on that. Matt Lalonde functions better on that. You know, you, Andy functions better on that. Like, this is just kind of the signal that we're sending out to the universe here. And so people pick up on that signal, they give it a shot, and then the people who respond well to it usually end up, they're the people who tend to respond. So the people who respond better to a little higher carb intake, I think, are probably not as vocal on this thing, but there's no doubt that there's a huge spectrum in this, and you just have to play with it. I think that that is a nice point to play with. You could, you know, and especially because he is weighing and measuring his food. So it's like, okay, we have some really tight parameters on your data. Why don't you try sticking the lion's share of your carbohydrate in post-workout and see how you look, feel, and perform? And then you could start playing with like reducing the carb intake, increasing the carb intake. Like if you're being that detail-oriented about it, it's a really nice thing to play with.
Yes, and it would drive me crazy. next, moving on, what do you think is a good protein level and macronutrient balance for the CAWOD, intermittent fasting, good or bad? Anything else I should consider changing?
I think definitely that gram of protein per pound of body weight, the overall, you know, macronutrient again is going to be really predicated on how you run. Some people tend to run a little bit better on a little bit higher carbs, but I just see, so it seems like about 70% of folks seem to run better on a little bit fewer carbs, you know, fewer being probably 50 to 100 grams a day max, and just getting the bulk of those carbs from a green leafy vegetable type things. Seems like so many people seem to run better on that. Then total caloric intake is just going to be kind of predicated on, are you just trying to maintain current levels and kind of optimize, say, like strength to body weight ratio, or are you trying to get bigger? And that's going to dictate how, you know, your overall caloric intake. Intermittent fasting, again, maybe beneficial, maybe not. Talking to Martin Burkham, the Lean Gains guy, super sharp dude. He seems to get some really good results out of the intermittent fasting with the folks that he works with, whereas I have had much more mixed returns, but he's working with much more kind of strength and bodybuilder type folks. But the CrossFitters that he's working with, he is also prescribing their training, and interestingly, they're doing a ton less real ball-busting metabolic conditioning, and they're doing a bunch more strength work, a little bit more low-level, like strongman, you know, like flip a tire, swing some sledgehammer-type stuff, and so they're doing some intermediate-level GPP-type stuff that's not white buffalo in the sky, puke-on-your-shoes-type things. So I think when you couple some intermittent fasting with some smarter programming that's not just predicated on metabolic conditioning, you maybe have a good situation there. So it might be something worth revisiting. I had kind of, I wouldn't say given up on intermittent fasting, but I had seen such mixed results with it that I was reticent to really drive it much further.
Yep. All right, good. And then the... One more extremely important question. Is scotch gluten-free or not? Mixed info online, big implications for life.
I think it's probably gluten-free given the fact that it's been distilled. It's not born gluten-free, but I think it finishes gluten-free. But you could always go with tequila. So.
Or vodka.
Or vodka, yeah.
I just want to say that my favorite part of all these questions is it always comes down to caffeine and alcohol. People change everything else, but they're really worried about, can I have my two cups of coffee? Am I gonna lose all my benefits if I have some scotch?
You need your uppers so that you can actually get work done, and then you need your beer goggles so that you can get laid at some point. So I think that's where the whole thing plays out. So
get laid at some point. Quote of the day, Rob Wolf is always Rob Wolf, whether on Vicodin or not.
Andy's wife is like, you know, you guys are idiots.
Yeah, but I don't need you to
fertilize the field there. Yeah.
That's already, that's par for the course.
Yes, yes.
And then finally says, thank you. Sorry for all the recent drama. Thank you for the service to the CrossFit community. Right on with the right on. I like that.
Thanks to him.
I'm going to use that today in a sentence. So next we have a question from Nicholas. Attended your cert at B2B CrossFit in Atlanta, paleo for 25 days, and am confused with regards to fruit. Essentially, I do not know how much to consume or which type are best. While I've been eating lots of meats and vegetables, I stayed away from fruit for the most part because I'm scared of sugar intake pre-WOD. I know there is something wrong with this, and you encourage tweaking of carbs and in terms of felt lethargy and such. The problem is I don't feel lethargic. I feel highly energized and ready to rock and roll on WODs. That doesn't mean I'm not consuming the right amount, though, because just like you said in regards to eliminating gluten, you may not feel like shit, but how you do know what you're supposed to feel like if you've never done without it. I need some way of knowing how much fruit I need. I'm 25, 147, 5'9", and lean. If you've answered in the past, I'm sorry. Blah, blah, blah. Had the Kurt Cobain tattoo, if you remember. Do you remember?
Oh yeah, I totally do. I totally do. Yeah, really good dude. So
Where's the Kurt Cobain tattoo? Let's start with the important stuff.
I believe it was like a torso, like
All
a
right.
yeah, either torso or arm. I forget. I do remember the tattoo though.
See, Rob, I just want to, this is all part of
Oh,
this.
and the reason why that came up is because I did a workout at that seminar, and it was a playlist that was all Nirvana. So, and he
Oh.
came up and he was like, "Dude, I'm sorry, I just got to show you this." So, so what's the question? What does it boil down to here? Like the how much fruit
How much
or if fruit?
fruit? And especially, he stayed away from fruit for the most part because he's scared of sugar intake pre-WOD, basically because of lethargy and stuff. And he just, the feeling is, he doesn't feel lethargic. He feels great.
Again, this is it's so, man. I need to sit down and see if I can create more of a like a logic tree on this stuff. It's like if you're this, then do this. If you're this, then do this. But there's just so many variables to all this stuff. Post WOD nutrition kind of, we've covered this just ad nauseum, I feel like, but it really breaks down to, do you want to lean out? Yes or no. If you don't want to lean out, then do you feel, are you trying to gain muscular body weight? Yes or no. And if you're not, then it's kind of like, are you carb tolerant or not carb tolerant? Yes or no. And so that's kind of a flow that you can do with all that sort of stuff. And that's pretty solid. Like there's some really solid argument for post-WOD nutrition, for recovery and whatnot, but it will be somewhat predicated on what your current status is with regard to leanness, what your goals are, all that sort of jive. And then the pre-WOD nutrition is really, really subjective. And again, it's based off of what are your goals and where are you at? If the, he's saying that he's lean. I'm not sure what what the goal is though. And that's really a lot of what drives the boat here. If it's just generally like rocking the CrossFit wads and whatnot, then I would just get in and experiment with that carb intake. Really common practice with like the targeted or cyclic ketogenic diets where people are very, very low carb most of the time, but then right before a workout, they would eat an orange, they'd eat an apple, they'd have some grapes or something like that. Those things are kind of a nice mix because they are some glucose and a little bit of fructose. The fructose will refill the liver glycogen a little bit, not too much because we're only having like one piece of fruit. It does technically kick you out of ketosis, but if you're doing that right before a workout, what it's going to do is allow you to train at a much higher intensity level. And that intensity level is the absolute measure of intensity, whether we're talking about strength training, a la percent of your one rep max, or intensity from the perspective of a broad times modal domains, we're getting our CrossFit WOD on. Both of those intensities really kind of boil down to similar entities. And if you have low blood sugar levels at those points, you're probably not going to optimize that work output. But it's very, very subjective. You need to figure out where you're at with that and then tinker with it. But I see absolutely no problem throwing down like an orange, some grapes, blueberries, whatever, right before a WOD, and see how you do with that and see if you perform better on it. I mean, it's one of those things that's definitely fair game to experiment with and see how you do.
This just shows how lazy I am, because I'm like, if you feel great, let's just roll with it for now. We'll try to fix it later.
Yeah, and that, to some degree, that, you know, that's definitely true too. You know, it's that thing, if it's not broken, don't fix it. You know, Matt Lalonde had a really, like, looking at his example, he's kind of shifted from standard CrossFit wads, was doing the OPT wad for a while, now he's doing CrossFit football, he's totally killing stuff. He rolls into it with essentially, like, he's doing like a two meal a day thing. He benched 5x2 at 285 or 295 the other day, and like destroyed the CrossFit football wad, and he had not eaten anything in like 6 hours, you know, and is killing that stuff. Now it begs the question, would he do even better having been fed? I don't know, but what he's doing is working great, and he's just experimenting with it and running with it, and he's making progress. Like, each time he comes back to the gym, he's setting PRs and he's feeling good and he's working great in the lab, and it's very, very simple. I mean, think about how simplified a 2-meal-a-day plan is with regards to your life. And the dude's a 180, has over 1,000-pound CrossFit total, great numbers on the wads, and he, you know, simple life. So it's something to be said for figuring out, you know, the Art Devaney approach, like the Russian approach, like minimum investment, maximum return, versus the Bulgarian deal, which is like, you know, how can I make my life as neurotic as possible such that I have not a moment of peace where I'm not thinking about my food or training, you know?
Seriously.
Yeah.
Your Devaney comment reminds me, did you see the recent news piece they did on Devaney?
Yeah, that was cool. That was pretty cool. We should throw that one up too.
Yeah, I'll throw the link up. Although, I'm always shocked at, like, I think somehow the media always portrays him as a lunatic, and I'm like... I'm like, the man is in his 70s. Look at him. Like, you know.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, the nutrition professor that they interviewed, and he was like, well, it's compelling. That dude is in his mid-50s, and he looks like absolute crap. And then Devaney is more than 20 years older than he is. And, it, you know, granted, it's a sample size of one, but it's like, dude, give me a break here. Yeah, you know, it's Devaney and Wonder Woman are kicking ass. They're looking good.
I love the fact that they're pulling their Range Rovers in the driveway.
Yeah, totally. How much do their neighbors hate them? I just love that, too. I want to buy Devaney a Prowler and mail it to him just so he can seriously piss off his neighbors.
Push it up and down the street.
Exactly, yeah. And we won't give him the Teflon bottom, too. Like, it's going to be all up and down the street.
Rob Wolf causing problems.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Good question. I like the Kurt Cobain tattoo. That's nice.
Yeah. Yep.
This is why we, you know, this also reminds me of why we don't pre-screen the questions, Rob. This is much more real, you know.
And it allows you to show what a complete idiot I am, so.
Well, you know, I had this discussion with Kelly Starrett that, you know, all these things should be, there's a little bit of performance art to all this, Rob. We're trying to move the mic one step further away from where you want it so that this is real.
I'll keep that in mind. Good.
God help us all.
Yeah, God help us all.
All right, now I got a question from Kevin. Recently, a discussion about paleo came up on our local climbing site, and the detractor's argument was that why aren't elite athletes doing paleo? Could you name some elite athletes doing paleo? Mark Twite is the only one I know of.
Shoot. I thought that we had this one before. Maybe I just saw this one pop up. Joe Friel, Training Bible LLC sort of gig, like the Triathletes Training Bible, the Runners Training Bible. The guy has coached a ton of people to Olympic caliber triathlon. His whole gig is the paleo diet. We've got Glenn Cordoza, who's a world champion MMA fighter. There are a lot of people out there. Maybe what we need to do is do a little bit of a name dropping roundup, and we could consolidate as many people as we can think of in this list. If you really look at, like, the nutrition of most high caliber, like Olympic weightlifters, strongman competitors, they look a lot more paleo than not. And it starts getting a little bit murky, because it's kind of like, okay, they're doing some protein powder. This guy's doing, you know, some milk or some dairy or some yogurt or something. So it gets a little bit murky, like, what exactly is paleo and what isn't. But there are a lot of people more this way than not. We could try to do some sort of a roundup on that and do some name dropping on it.
Well, and I think, there's some consistency with some folks with recommendations, like, Paul Check. I would, he may not use the word paleo, but that's paleo diet, Poliquin. But some of this I always come back to, like, does this really matter? And so I always struggle with, like, in the CrossFit world, like, everyone's looking at, the CrossFit finalist and what they're doing and then how that training program applies to the average individual. And I'm always like, I don't think it applies at all.
Right.
And as you and I well know, in some cases, some of the most elite athletes that we have ever worked with or known or were friends with probably did everything that you shouldn't do
And we're elite anyway.
in
Yeah.
spite of it. And then so I always go back to, okay, what are we doing that applies to the broadest spectrum of the population? And I feel like what we've seen is that paleo diet, works amazingly well, simple, great results, moves everything in the direction we want. And then I don't spend a lot of time thinking about, how does what Brett Favre eats impact, my local accountant that I train or something.
Right. And this makes me think. When I was talking to Professor Cordain a couple hours ago, his book came out in, I think, 2002, 2001, 2002. It sold pretty well. He had some pretty good media exposure, and then it kind of slid into the somewhat normal obscurity of most, nutrition and diet books. And then an interesting thing has happened. Over the course of a 5-year period, his book has been selling better and better and better. And granted, I'm not a huge fan of everything in his book. Like, we've got some of the issues with like only 2 eggs a week or 6 eggs a week or whatever. There's some minor things there, but there's a really, really compelling point, which is this: none of this Barry Sears books, none of the Zone books, none of the Atkins books, not even as much as I love the Protein Power Life Plan book, none of these other books have seen a resurgence in their sales. The paleo diet and the paleo diet for athletes are now in the Amazon top 200, and the sales are climbing. And there's a really compelling question for that. Why? And the answer for that is, and Cordain threw this out there. He shot this to me in an email, and I included this email in the Paleo Brand seminar, in the presentation that I did for the Paleo Brand seminar, which is basically in complex human systems, the stuff that works gets picked up and understood and gets disseminated, and the stuff that doesn't work doesn't get spread around. And so there's a lot of elements of CrossFit, for example, that work very, very well. Intensity, group camaraderie, and all the rest of that stuff, it works really, really well. And so this is a lot of the reason for the dissemination of that technology. Weighing and measuring your food doesn't work as a baseline, as an intervention. As much as people have tried to sell that, it's bullshit and it doesn't work. And that's why, this resurgence in the paleo stuff, and even after the CrossFit Level 1 trainer Wingding, apparently they have backpedaled, and now they're saying, well, CrossFit's always been paleo and meat and vegetables, nuts and seeds, some fruit, little starch, no sugar. And God love them, because you can only sing a false song for so long before you start looking like an idiot. So they finally had to come around and own what's actually working. And so when people focus so much on the elite, on these outliers, it just doesn't tell us much of anything. But when you look at what works in the broadest circumstances, then we see this kind of more or less paleo approach: meat and vegetables, nuts and seeds, some fruit, a little starch, no sugar. You pull gluten out of the Roundup. You minimize dairy in the people who are particularly sensitive to it. Increase protein intake. Make sure that good fats are dealt with. And we end up dealing with like everything under the sun. And so people have better performance, they have better recovery, they have lower inflammation levels. And then there are just some people who can do anything they damn well please, and they're still going to have remarkable performance.
Amen. Going to train just like Dave Tate. I'm sure I'll get the same results.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Question from Matt. Where do coffee with unsweetened coconut milk and the occasional wine fall into the paleo equation? See, everyone's all about alcohol today. If this was already answered, please accept my apologies for repeating. Thanks. Love the site and the podcasts.
Yeah, I think we hammered this one pretty well. The therapeutic dose on coffee, wine, kind of prefer the red wines over the white wines just because of the sugar content. Obviously, there are a ton of people who own gyms and are trainers and coaches and everything. And so this practical aspect of like the social element of drinking is really, really important. In our practice, we have had a number of clients that their business, particularly realtors, a significant amount of their business involves like socializing and shaking hands and kissing babies and being out and about with people. And when we have really curtailed their drinking, they're like, dude, I'm not making any money. Like, I'm not a fun person to be around, like, and all this stuff. And so you have to find some sort of a buy-in for people to with regards to the alcohol intake that works for their social level, for what type of stuff they have going on with their work and their downtime. I think generally, like the red wine deal is a pretty good option. Definitely the NorCal margaritas are a good option. And my same recommendation again, drink early, hit it on an empty stomach, finish off with protein and fat. And that way, you tend to disrupt your growth hormone release as little as possible. And you still have some fun, get your head changed, and all the rest of that stuff.
Get your head changed is a Rob Wolfism.
I think somebody else coined it before me, but I've made good use of it.
Good question. No
Yeah.
more alcohol questions.
Until next week.
We are okay with alcohol in reasonable, responsible
Yeah,
doses.
yeah.
Okay. All right, moving on. Question from Ben. This question is sort of funny only because it highlights how long the question queue is.
Right.
Because he said, "Hope you had a relaxing Christmas, Hanukkah, or Kwanzaa. Whatever it was, hope it was nice."
We're
He's.
working our way as quickly as we can through them. Obviously, not very quickly, though.
Well, clearly it keeps growing, which I think is a positive sign.
Yeah.
So Ben says he's digging the podcast and has a question I don't remember hearing about yet. He believes in food quality with paleo foods, but don't quite understand how to teach my parents about it. Here is my problem. My dad will go to the gym in the morning to work out, and then he'll come home and eat a banana and an apple and tell me he's eating paleo. I tell him that I think he's making a wise choice using fruit as his carb source rather than oatmeal, but I'm not crazy about the idea of him eating 40 plus grams of carbs, no protein, no fat. I understand that it's not paleo, but wouldn't it be better for my dad to eat cottage cheese or a Greek yogurt? I know that cottage cheese and Greek yogurt are not paleo, but the macronutrient ratio is higher in fat, protein, and lower in carbs and fructose. One of my friends says that if he ever became a nutritionist, he would tell a client to choose a piece of whole bread over a banana. Not quite sure about this one, but it does bring the whole macronutrient concept into focus.
Egads. Wow, this is actually kind of a interesting question. Maybe one thing is that, when you work, say, like as a trainer or a coach, and it's real similar to a kind of a medical profession thing, like the recommendation is to not work with your family, like the likelihood of you being successful with your family, of having any type of like entangling issues is really, really high. But obviously, nobody's going to listen to that good advice, and so they're going to do whatever they're going to do. And so, in that case, actually, maybe showing him some of the Art Devaney stuff that Devaney does his workouts, and then wraps up with some protein primarily. He fasts a little bit and then does some protein for like the growth hormone response and some of the stress adaptation genes that are flipped on post-workout that help deal with repleting glycogen stores, and there are some cool elements to that. The Matt Lalonde post on low carb CrossFitting, I think, is a good place to look for some of that, and then obviously any of Art Devaney stuff. And then from there, like if Pops is not going to do that, then we've got a question of like a banana and an apple versus Greek yogurt. I would actually lean to the banana and the apple just because of the other kind of inflammatory issues associated with the dairy. Kind of prostatitis type issues. Like again, people forget that it's not just protein, carbs, and fat. It's also the other growth promoting elements of dairy, and you just don't need that stuff. Given somebody who's probably in their like 60s or 70s, something like that. And then the thing about like the piece of bread versus the banana, like Christ, gluten. Vitamins, minerals, acid-base balance, like there is no basis whatsoever for recommending a piece of whole wheat bread over a banana. Like, I'm not particularly a fan of a banana, but nutrition-wise, like, and also let's take this a step further. Let's remove what little nutritive value that is in whole wheat bread is because it's enriched. Like, they add nutrients to it because it's so carbohydrate dense that when you process carbohydrates in the liver, it requires B vitamins. And there's such little nutrient density in grains, even whole grains, that you end up behind the curve on the B vitamins. And this is where you end up with like pellagra and some of the other B vitamin deficiency diseases from eating a whole lot of grains if they're not fortified. So this person who says if they ever became a nutritionist, he would tell the client to choose a piece of whole wheat bread over a banana. It's like, gee whiz. Just makes me want to cry. So.
Yeah, and I think your answer is interesting because I think to you and I, we would always choose the stricter paleo food, no matter really what the macronutrient ratios were,
Right,
over
right.
the non-paleo food, even though it may appear that the macronutrient ratios are a little better.
Matt Lalonde and I were talking a little bit yesterday just about some of the Katavan stuff and lectins and gut irritation and the likelihood that various grains cause leptin resistance and therefore insulin resistance and whatnot. And he points out that, you know, most of the Asian cultures, like they eat like polished white rice, which has removed almost all of the phytates and anti-nutrients out of the rice, interestingly. And it's actually only in the States that you really see people going after the brown rice and whatnot. And so even in those circumstances, they on some sort of an instinctual level have been removing. Now, granted, there are some B vitamins in that brown rice and the rice bran and all that sort of stuff, but if you're eating a little bit of vegetables, a little bit of meat, you end up offsetting that pretty quickly. So it's just kind of an interesting gig while you're minimizing the amount of gut irritants and anti-nutrients by going with more of like a polished white rice. It's kind of a funny deal.
I'm just laughing, Rob, because someone just posted a comment on your blog offering to get us a DVD copy of Rad.
I saw that. I saw that.
Feel like we've created a whole side conversation about movies. I'm sorry, Rob. I'm sorry for ruining your blog.
We could do a movie night at NorCal too and have Rad and a few other goodies. So
And people would hate us forever.
yeah.
All right, next we got a question from Bill. He hears conflicting accounts on how protein is utilized, and his quandary is this. Barry Sears. On one hand, I hear Sears and others say my body can't absorb more than 40 to 50 grams of protein in a single meal and thus support the approach of getting my 200 grams of protein a day spread through 4 to 5 meals. On the other hand, I often read about people doing a 5-hour feeding window and getting great results. I personally know Dallas, and he's pretty beastly on the heavy weight, so he must be absorbing the protein when he's doing IF, right? So, if aiming for 200 grams of protein a day, should I just cram it all in during a 5-hour window and fast the other 19 if I'm wanting to play with IF? So, let's start there.
Oh man. So let's back up even a little bit further than this. Let's just do an accounting of some scientists and coaches and the diets they recommend and the diets they eat. Palchik, Poliquin, Cordain, Joe Friel. These people are all like, I would call them practicing athletes. And even let's expand that out. Matt Thornton of Straight Blast Gym, John Frankel, who's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu under Straight Blast Gym, a PhD from Harvard in Korean literature. All these guys are coaches and athletes. All of them eat essentially like a paleo diet, unweighed, unmeasured kind of paleo diet sort of gig. That's what they advocate. That's what they eat. They walk their walk their talk, you know, however you want to look at that sort of stuff. Then you look at Barry Sears and contemporaries of Barry Sears, and they recommend a diet that they can't even follow themselves. You know, just as a baseline, they don't train currently, which I think the not training yourself is a interesting deal. Say, like, Poliquin has an interesting thing that he has. I forget if it's like four levels to his programming. training, but most of it is built around strength development, but they also have circuit-based training that's very, very similar to CrossFit, and he makes all of his coaches go through that stuff because it's horrific training, very, very painful. The lactate, you know, accumulation is painful, and it hurts, and it makes you vomit, and all the rest of that stuff. And he makes all of the coaches that go through that course go through these modules, you know, like 8 weeks of it, because he wants the people who are going to be prescribing workouts to have a very intimate understanding of how badly that stuff sucks. So I think whenever you become separated from the training process, the coaching process, and the actual eating process that you are recommending, the likelihood that your feet are still based in reality is very, very unlikely. And so then we start getting these wacky claims about, like, you can't absorb more than like 35 or 40 grams of protein and stuff like that. You look at like Mauro DiPasquale, Wellborn, you know, all these other, the people that I mentioned before, they are absolutely absorbing more than 40 or 50 grams of protein in a sitting. And it is not causing some sort of horrific protein, you know, insulin response that, you know, like when Barry Sears in the CrossFit Journal piece said that he would prefer you eat a small piece of protein with a Twinkie versus like a large steak. You know, I mean, I just can't find a more illustrated point than that as just kind of a baseline. And so that's piece number one. Piece number two, would sticking all your calories in a 5-hour feeding window be a good way to go? It might be. There is some interesting literature floating around out there that sticking the lion's share of your protein immediately post-workout, and like the lion's share being, say, like if you were going to take in 200 grams of protein in a day, you might take in 150 grams post-workout, that there may actually be some really significant benefit to that with regards to that kind of pulsatile growth response. Not a lot of data on it. It's hard to do, but there's some compelling stuff there.
So my only tidbits is, yes, Dallas is a beast, so he's clearly absorbing protein.
Yes, he's absolutely absorbing protein. Yeah.
You know, and for accuracy's sake, Rob, I think actually Barry Sears is talking about weighing and measuring ding-dongs versus eating a plate of ribs.
Thank you for the clarification there. Okay.
Because that's the kind of stupid stuff that I remember.
Okay.
And then the secondary question on this is, he wants to know, where should his workouts fit in those windows if he does play with the feeding windows? He feels strongest on heavy lifting days if I've eaten. So he's thinking eat, work out within 2 hours or so, and then eat all the rest within another 3 hours.
That sounds smart. Like you would do a small meal just to kind of prime the pump, get maybe a little bit of caffeine in, and then hit it, and then post-workout is the lion's share of your calories.
All right, good. And then finally says, for what it's worth, 5'10", or he's 5'10", 210. He can stand to lose 20 pounds of those, but it's not concerned at the moment. Just working to get my squat over 400 and deadlift over 500. I love this guy.
Yeah, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. You could make the argument for trying to simplify this whole thing, say like a 3 to 4 meals a day approach, and try to get to those numbers and make it a little more conventional and streamlined. But, you know, if he's making some progress on this other thing, and there again, like if it's real simple and like he feels good and he's making progress, then good to go. The one thing that, you know, again, the intermittent fasting can be a stress. So if he gets any type of like cortisol type problems or some insulin management problems, then that might be something that he would want to soften up on, is the duration and the frequency of the intermittent fasting.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of food. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I would almost think you'd start just spreading it out through the day, see how you do, and then maybe drop some of that stuff in. But maybe it's easier for him. That would be hard for me to get all that food in that short of a window and not just be a wreck.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, on a totally unrelated topic, Rob, a recent blog post by Jason Frugia, so blog number 9,000 that I read, he had a pretty funny blog post that was just, I thought was funny. It was basically his point that even though he's in the fitness industry, he does not care about people losing weight. And he was like, when people find out I'm a trainer, they always ask how to lose weight. He says, I do not care. All I care about is taking someone with a 200-pound squat to a 600-pound squat. I just want to make people big. Do not ask me anything else. I'm not interested.
Dude, props to him, because that's a, find your focus and your bliss and then run with it. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
that was a great post. My God, I love it.
That's cool.
All right, next we got a question from Unknown. I think you touched on this actually on the blog a couple weeks ago actually now, but I think this is an interesting question to touch upon. So, I've been through a lot of stress in the past couple years, had issues with eczema, asthma, illness, etc. Since going paleo, all this has cleared up. I was surprised how quickly it happened. I've also had a substantial amount of hair loss. As a female, this was truly terrifying. I've lost about 50% and was hoping that the paleo diet would help with that as well. Is there something additional I should be taking to help correct this? I do have some new hair growth, but it has been months to see that change. Any advice? I have been paleo for a year.
The alopecia, the hair loss can be related to kind of to in females, what we're talking about here, kind of an autoimmune response that we see real tight linkage with gluten and that whole transglutaminase issue, and also just stress. The cortisol can actually interrupt the growth promoting signal at the follicle. And so the hairs can just fall out and cease to grow. And so you drop cortisol levels, drop stress levels, remove gluten, dairy, all that sort of stuff out of the rotation. And interestingly, here's this thing where I've just got to point it out. All those things are very, very synergistic, both positively and negatively with regards to stress. If we eat a food that we have an intolerance to, that releases cortisol. It's a stressor for us. So when you remove these foods, not only are we minimizing gut irritation and direct activity that could be an autoimmune reaction at the hair follicle, we're also reducing cortisol levels. And so there's a bunch of synergy to all this stuff that really works well. The only other thing that I would maybe throw in is like a solid multivitamin, like a B vitamin, multivitamin. There's definitely some cofactors in there that would be helpful. And then also like 5,000 IUs of vitamin D, because vitamin D is really, really important kind of skin and hair health. And easily something that could be deficient in this person, particularly if she had some gut irritation in the past.
All right. Next, we got a question from Mary. She says, "Thank you for your informative podcast. Really appreciate the hard work." She is a 44-year-old female, 5'1", currently 106 pounds, following low-carb diet, no legumes, raw milk-based dairy only. Weight trains 3 times a week for 30 minutes. Walks 4 times a week for 30 minutes. She reduced her carbs from 130 grams to 50 grams in April 2009 and restricted my calories to 1,200 daily, EGADS, and lost 5 pounds over 3 months. Although I love the way I felt initially, that seemed to have triggered a hormonal response. My period stopped completely. I'm currently on Cytomel, and my blood work shows no menopause. Any suggestions, ideas on changes to my nutrition, workout routine, etc.?"
Sounds like she just needs to up her calories a little bit. Like
Yeah.
she doesn't mention how much protein she's getting in. I would definitely make sure that she's getting at least a gram of protein per pound of body weight, and then just really start ladling on some extra fat, get some vitamin D in there, and add in some fish oil, probably, I don't know, maybe about 4 or 5 grams of EPA DHA a day would be good. Seems like she's just not hardly eating anything. She's itty bitty. I mean, 5'1", 106, but as you age, you don't want to lose muscle mass like it for any reason. So I would want to see her, up her calories just a bit. And I like the fact she's strength training 3 times a week. That's cool. That sounds good.
Yeah, this is kind of like one of those things. Like, I have a lot of clients at the gym that are like 240-pound males, and I'm like, "What'd you have for breakfast?" And they're like, "Two eggs and a slice of bacon." And then I'm like, "Okay, we're gonna go over and look, and we're gonna ask that 112-pound, very lean, fit female what she had for breakfast." And they're like, "Okay, we'll go over." And she's like, "I had 6 eggs, 5 pieces of bacon, and half an avocado."
Right. And the guy's like, "Oh, okay. Roger that."
So, yeah, that is, I mean, obviously she is a fairly small girl, but that is not a lot of calories.
No, and I don't think enough. And classic deal, like if the amenorrhea kind of thing, if the lack of menstrual cycle is kicking in, then try to up the calories a little bit and see if that normalizes things. And maybe direct her to last week's episode where we talked about the whole amenorrheic thing, and that may or may not even be that big of a deal, but I would like to see her doing a little more calories.
Yeah. Yes. Please. Last question of the day, Rob. Oh, am I wrong? Oh, we have two more. I'm sorry. The listeners were excited. Threw you off. We're at 1 hour and 9 minutes.
Cool. We'll be fast.
Question from Nathan. Thank you for all the work you do educating people. Personally, really grateful that you're out there as a resource. The owner of the box I work at was talking about fasting today as a precursor to starting paleo. He went on to tell a couple of clients that a fast of up to a month is no big deal and that the body doesn't need food. I know you're a proponent of intermittent fasting, and from what I can gather on your site, you don't mean anything near that long. It seems like the ideal time to do short fasts is once you've got paleo down and you're sleeping enough every night. Should we be telling people to fast for 48 hours before starting paleo? When you say intermittent fasting, how often and how long would you say to do it?
Wow.
Lost in translation
I
somewhere.
am just shocked, really. Recommending that people do like a month-long fast, just see one thing, if you own a gym and you're recommending that, I just, what the hell? You know, I don't, man, I could spend an hour on this. We're already over topic. I think that's a horrible recommendation. Unless there's some real deep qualifiers in here, which I would be very, very curious to hear, I cannot see any reason for recommending that. If for no other reason, like the compliance is going to be shit on that. Nobody's going to starve themselves for days on end. They're going to have horrible performance. They're going to lose muscle mass. It's kind of maddening. Very, very frustrating. There's really no reason to do, for the most part, any type of fasting over about 16 hours. The maximum benefit, minimum downside is at that 16-hour point. So anything from like 12 to 16 hours is plenty. Beyond that, you have to go like 48 hours or longer before you potentially start getting any other metabolic benefit. And during that period from like 16 to 48 hours, you are metabolizing the most protein that you're going to lose the most protein out of your muscles that you're going to during the whole process. So I just can't see any recommendation for that. And here again, like if people will just, I don't know why people need to make this so extreme. If you just eat breakfast, lunch, dinner, kind of lowish carb paleo, hunk of protein, some fat, and some veggies, you will typically lean, like a short of like that Charles Poliquin thing again, you need to understand that there's a difference between a mouth and a vacuum cleaner. So, like if you're eating reasonably sized portions, you're going to lose weight. You're going to change your metabolic function. You're going to improve your performance. And it's not that big a deal. It's not that horrible of a thing versus turning this into just kind of a circus and something that is completely unlivable. Like, this is not sustainable stuff. And then if you want to drop in a little intermittent fasting, fine. But I would rather just see your food quality get dealt with, like they mentioned, get your sleep in. And then if you want to play with compressing the feeding window a little bit, then fine. But yeah, this other stuff just creeps me out.
The cult of Rob Wolf.
Yeesh.
All right, good. That was a good question. And the last one I think is actually pretty interesting. I think we touched on this a tiny bit last week, actually, but I kind of like the angle of the question. So, hey, Rob, love the podcast. So much of what I hear in nutrition is supplement with magnesium and vitamin D. And my question is this: how do we know if there'll be long-term effects from this? For years, people have been told about taking hormones and vitamin E and others, only to find out that it doesn't work the way it once thought, or it is potentially dangerous. Is it better to be possibly deficient in something like magnesium or vitamin D, or to take a supplement that may either be a waste or potentially cause harm? I hope this makes sense.
It's a great question, you know, like oh, man, I try to make this one concise because I know we're over time here. We know that there's, but part of the aging process is this free radical, you know, damage, oxidative damage to our DNA, oxidative damage to our proteins. So we understand that these things called reactive oxygen species from cellular metabolism, they underlie part of the aging process. So then there was this thought, okay, well, we'll take big doses of antioxidants, which scavenge and clean up these reactive oxygen species, and this should prevent the aging process, and it should also prevent some elements of degenerative disease. So we started dosing animals, started dosing people with high amounts of antioxidants, vitamin C, vitamin E, all that sort of stuff. Lo and behold, we saw actually no benefit and actually some worsening of problems. So what we figured out from that is that there's this whole process, hormesis, where you get exposed to transitory peaks and troughs of oxidative damage. Then your body becomes immunized against that. And exercise is a primary example of this. Eating a smart kind of paleo-type diet is an example of this because we take in naturally occurring antioxidants in the amounts and ratios that we kind of co-evolved with, and we find a lot of benefit from this. So there's kind of some synergy there where it's like, do we need vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants? Yeah, we do better on that, but we tend to do better from food type levels and food type sources than we do from supplement levels, which tend to be, sky high, kind of off the chart levels. So then it begs the question, well, what about the vitamin D and the magnesium? Vitamin D, in the past, we tended to make a ton of it for the most part, or when we ate the livers of animals, we ended up getting a ton of it. So dietarily, we ended up, by hook or by crook, usually having a whole lot of vitamin D in our system. And then also the magnesium, historically, we ended up getting a lot of magnesium. It's a really good question, but and we have seen some examples of like supplements not really being of huge benefit. But I would bet the farm that magnesium supplementation and vitamin D supplementation is not going to have any type of downside. I could be wrong. It's a really good, it's a very astute question, but I would be shocked if there ended up being some sort of a downside with that stuff.
I could think about this question for 2 days and not come up with the best answer.
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's a ton there. But on the keeping the brevity, I think these two items in particular, fish oil, if we're keeping an eye on kind of ancestral ratios, I think we're very safe with that.
All right. Well, with that, Rob, I think that's episode 15. I'm going to go think of some more abstract 80s movies to watch.
Sweet. I dig it.
And hopefully you'll recover fast from your little situation, and we'll talk to you next week.
Awesome.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, Andy.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.